Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the OIES. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by David Robinson and Malcolm Key, who are senior research fellows at the Institute, to discuss the key messages that came from their recent paper, Glimpses of the Future Electricity System, Demand Flexibility, and a Proposal for a Special Auction, that was published in October 2020. Gentlemen, it's very nice to have you here. Now, Malcolm, why don't I come to you first? I must say, I really like the title of your paper, but can you share with our listeners, why is there a question mark in the title? And also, why did you decide to write this paper at this time?
Well, we are, David, saying that we've had seen in the energy market in the first part of this year, particularly during the COVID lockdown, some features which we have seen forecast by many forecasters for much later in the 2030s or 2040s. And that was very interesting to us because we thought we might be able to draw some lessons from it. We're not saying it's the exact future, because, and that's why there's a question mark in the title, but we are saying that it's a sort of dress rehearsal for the future, and we can look at the challenges we're facing and try and draw some lessons from it and learn from the experience.
Interesting. So this is a dress rehearsal, which I think we'll see kind of the kind of structure you're proposing and kind of suggestions as we go through this podcast. Well, look, David, can I come to you perhaps? So I'd like to step back a bit, if I can, and focus on the fundamental question. You know, what has been the main impact of the COVID epidemic with regard to energy in general? Perhaps you can give us an insight.
Well, I think the first and most important one is a decline in global energy demand. We saw in the first quarter a reduction in global demand of about 3.6%. This was especially acute in the case of coal, which fell by 8% in the same period, mainly due to a decline in the demand from the power and industrial sectors, but also substitution by gas and renewables in the power sector. Global oil demand also fell, in this case, by 5%. And this reflected travel restrictions and a decline in shipping. But what we also saw was a shift towards electricity. Demand for electricity also fell, but by much less than the others. And what we saw was an increase in the in residential use, which is what we expected. This whole scenario is consistent, as Malcolm said, with scenarios that we imagined that forecasters have had for some time, for the period, say, 2030 to 2050.
Interesting. So Malcolm, you know, what's your view? What do you see as the main impacts on electricity? Were there more that we should be discussing?
Yes. What's happened to electricity, the primary feature has been that the share of renewables has grown very fast. This is partly because electricity demand fell and partly because renewables output continued to grow, because there was quite a lot of renewables already in the system being built, which came on stream. So what you found was electricity systems with a high share of renewables and also, pleasingly, a low carbon intensity. For instance, at the peak in the UK, we had renewables taking like something like 70% of total generation. And with an additional input from nuclear, carbon intensity fell quite substantially to less than 50 grams per kilowatt hour, which is a 90% reduction on the 1990 figure and had been the target for 2030. So as I say, you're seeing some of the goals that we're aiming at for a decarbonized electricity system, but you're also seeing some of the problems. As renewables output has grown, it's become increasingly difficult to manage the system. We've seen that in some places, like, for instance, California, there's been a very high level of curtailment of renewables, about double what it was the year before. We've seen possibly unpleasant impacts for consumers who've seen that wholesale electricity prices have fallen, but in many cases, their own prices have not fallen because various extra costs have been folded into their prices. We've also seen a sort of wider development, which in fact, I suppose we're exemplifying now, that there's an awful lot more use of electronic media for things like meetings and this sort of call. So we've seen a shift in demand to things that are powered by information technology in the wider sense. And again, we think that's going to be a feature of the future system.
Yeah, interesting. It's interesting you mentioned about the renewables example, of course, in the UK where you are. David is in Spain, where, you know, there's a huge amount of renewables use. But let me come to you, David, if I can. You know, are the changes that, you know, we've been discussing in this podcast in line with the main trends that you expect for the future decarbonized electricity system? Does that fit with you?
Absolutely, yes. Just mentioned three trends that were, if you want, anticipated and which we have witnessed. The first is that the new technology, that is renewables in particular, means that we've got a new approach to how the system operates. It used to be that generation was dispatchable and flexible and that demand was uncertain. So generation was the source of flexibility in the system and demand was, if you want, the uncertain part. But with the penetration of renewables, intermittent renewables, solar and wind, it's now the case that the generation side is the unpredictable side and that we need new sources of flexibility in order to match supply with demand, which, of course, is always necessary at every instant in the electricity sector. And demand side resources turn out to be an important source of that flexibility. The second change is in the cost structure. Basically, what we've seen is a move from the costs being heavily variable costs compared to fixed costs in the case of large, say, coal and gas plants, to one where most of the costs are fixed. So renewable costs are variable. Renewable costs are almost zero or usually zero, but the fixed costs are quite high. The result of this explains the price volatility. When the renewables are at the, you know, are at the margin, the prices are zero or sometimes negative. And when the others are at the margin, when the fossil fuel plants are at the margin, prices could be quite high. Anyway, this leads to a need for flexibility, which is the third big trend, and that is leading to a rising cost of balancing the system. In the UK, for instance, we've seen the cost of balancing rise from about 10% last year to over 20%. And that's basically to buy the flexibility needed to keep the supply in balance with demand.
Interesting. Well, let me come back to you, Malcolm, if I can, because you've already mentioned the UK and California. And in the paper, you note that both the UK and California have been particularly striking examples of what the future electricity system could be like in other countries. Perhaps you could tell our listeners, why is that?
I think there's two main reasons. Both the UK and California have quite aggressive decarbonisation strategies, a lot of which is focused on electricity. So they're all in some ways ahead of their peers in getting to the new decarbonised system. But they're also, and this complicates matters, relatively isolated systems. The UK, of course, is an island and is physically isolated, so its interconnections with other systems are relatively few. And California is, in a sense, a sort of on the edge of America and doesn't have a very large interconnection with the main cities and industrial areas in the East and Midwest. So both of these jurisdictions have had effectively to cope with the higher renewables and their variability on their own. Whereas within Europe, a country like Germany, which of course also has a strong renewables program, can export and import much more easily. So in many ways, it's found it easier to cope with the problems. But over time, as all of Europe gets a higher renewable share, it will also face the same problems. And therefore, in a sense, both the UK and California are guinea pigs for the way the rest of the world is going.
That's interesting. I never thought about the similarities between the two, but you've so clearly explained that, Malcolm. David, staying with you, Malcolm, you know, what were the more unexpected impacts in the UK?
As David said, the big picture impacts are ones that everyone expected. And some of them, implications, however, hadn't perhaps been thought through properly by everyone. If I can give an example, which is the role of nuclear power, A lot of people have been saying that in the decarbonized system, nuclear will be absolutely vital because what people want is a great big volume of steady baseload power. But that turned out not to be the case. You've in fact had in the UK a great deal of difficulty in managing the inflexible power from nuclear, which led in fact to the grid here paying the nuclear stations to turn off, because it is quite difficult to incorporate a big chunk of inflexible power into a system with a lot of variable power. I think the conclusion you can draw from that is that if we do need new nuclear within a low carbon system, it will have to be flexible nuclear. The need is not for baseload power, it is for flexibility. The same sort of picture applies to the demand side. That is, people have talked about demand response in the past, normally in terms of reducing demand at peak times. But actually, there may be a greater need for increasing demand at off-peak times when there is a high renewables output. So regulating demand upwards can be as important as regulating demand downwards. And again, that wasn't always in everyone's expectations for the future.
But of course, one message is clear, isn't it? Increased renewables penetration means the whole system has got to have more flexibility, which I think is fascinating. David, coming back to you, if I may, because I'd like to take the discussion back to the California example, if I may. Now, what lessons can be drawn from the California experience?
Well, first, it's important to explain what the experience was. We're talking about rolling blackouts that were scheduled by the system operator for the period after the sun went down. And this was because people continued to use their air conditioning. It was very hot weather. And as you said, as Malcolm said, there was not enough backup energy to meet that demand after the solar energy availability fell. So there are three messages. One is that California was clearly not prepared to cope with solar intermittency. And this leads to questions about their planning and who is responsible for security of supply. The second message is that demand flexibility is key. In the end, demand flexibility did help California to mitigate this problem. And it was as a result mainly of the governor and utilities going, on air and asking people please to turn down their air conditioning. But this was clearly an absence of incentives, financial incentives for demand-side flexibility. The market, in other words, is not well-designed. The prices were not giving the right signals, and this has to change. And the third one, I think, is that this is leading to a more general question about what is the future market and regulatory model for California as a decarbonized electricity sector.
Well, certainly that there are lessons very clearly from what you just told us. But do you think these lessons are applicable to other electricity systems, David?
I think so, because, first of all, I should say that every electricity system is going to be different because they'll have different resources that are available. But almost all modern electricity systems are going to have a greater proportion of intermittent renewables. And that means intermittency, which requires some kind of flexibility to cope with it. Also, the growth of distributed energy resources, that is, it could be solar panels on people's roofs or electric vehicles that are behind people's meter, as we say, they also introduce difficulties for managing the distribution network. And yet it's the digitization of these electrical devices that provide the sort of flexibility that can help to cope both with renewable intermittency and with the management of the distribution network.
Malcolm, can I come back to you and maybe ask you if there are any wider lessons for the other parts of the energy sector?
I think there are, though perhaps in a more general sense. One of the things that the electricity experience underlines is that if you're developing a lower carbon system, it's not just a matter of changing the fuel inputs, that is, changing from fossil fuels to renewables. The whole system changes and the way the system operates changes. And that's going to happen in other sectors too. For instance, once electric vehicles are introduced, electricity, transport sector rather, will become effectively part of the electricity system. It'll be a major new resource in terms of storage capacity for the electricity system. So those concerned with transport, whether it's providers of energy for transport or constructors of vehicles or battery constructors and designers, will need to think of themselves as not just in the mobility business, but in the electricity business. So it's going to mean a fairly fundamental rethink of the whole nature of the business, and more particularly is going to need a much greater degree of systems thinking, that is, of thinking of yourself as part of a wider system, not just of operating in isolation.
Interesting. Well, look, the paper, of course, you know, looks at the UK and the Californian examples, but then fundamentally it kind of creates this kind of two-market approach, the demand flexibility approach. And so, Malcolm, if I stay with you, you know, that you refer in the paper fundamentally to the proposal for electricity market reform. What is it you're actually trying to achieve with this proposal?
Well, we're trying to create a sustainable 21st century electricity market. The trouble with the market we've got just now is it's basically designed for the last century. As David mentioned earlier, variable costs were the main cost component in the 20th century electricity system. That is increasingly not the case because most renewables don't have any variable costs. The system we've got was designed for power stations like coal and gas ones, which firstly had relatively high variable costs and secondly were controllable. You could turn them on and turn them off when you needed them. The new system is going to be very different. So pricing according to the old system is not going to give useful price signals. So that the problem just now is that renewables have to be supported from outside the market, essentially. The costs of that, the other costs associated with the system, as David mentioned, for instance, balancing costs, the cost, for instance, in the United Kingdom of the capacity market, it's all added to the renewables support. And then we use the word smeared, that is spread across all customers. So this means that both the generators themselves and consumers really aren't getting effective price signals because they're not operating within a system designed for the technologies being used. What we're proposing is to get away from that by separating the two different sorts of technology, that is the high variable cost technology and the high capital cost technology, so they can operate separately within systems which suit themselves, and the price formation between each of these markets will be somewhat different.
Well, Sir David, can I come to you then and ask you, you know, perhaps a difficult question now? How is this proposal different from other ideas for market reform?
Well, I would say that the main difference is that our proposal looks both at upstream, that is generation, and the downstream, so the consumers. Most other models look fundamentally at the upstream and assume that if the signals there are good, that they will get through to the consumer. But usually, consumers do not get the right signals for the reasons Malcolm just explained. Giving you an example, one of the key proposals for reform is to introduce capacity markets, some sort of payment outside of the energy market to supplement the revenues that are earned in the energy market. And that focuses on paying firm generation capacity to be available to generate when needed. It provides reliability. But then, as Malcolm said, the costs of that are spread over all consumers as if they all had the same preferences as far as reliability was concerned. And we know that that's not true. The consumers have value reliability very differently. Our model, on the other hand, aims to give clear signals to consumers to limit, to minimize their need for reliability from the system. And it requires only those who require it to pay for it. So that's a fundamental difference that I would stress.
Interesting. Malcolm, can I come back to you and really ask you two questions, if I may? First of all, you know, can you expand a bit more on the elements of the market redesign proposal? And secondly, you know, reading the fascinating paper, the proposal seems very radical. So I wanted to ask if markets or policymakers have any appetite for such fundamental change.
On the first part of your question, What we're proposing, as I said, is to divide the electricity market into two separate markets. One we're calling the as-available market, and the other we're calling the on-demand market. The as-available market would consist of the intermittent sources like wind and solar, which, of course, generate as they're available, and consumers would get that power directly as it is available. The second market, the on-demand market, is the variable and flexible and controllable market. And if consumers wanted power from that market, they could pay for it and pay extra for it. You would find, for instance, that the costs of reliability, the costs of carbon, a carbon price, all these sort of costs would be loaded onto that on-demand market because that's where they belong. And therefore, prices would be rather higher there. Consumers would therefore have an incentive to use the cheaper as available electricity and maybe cover the rest of their demand either by reducing demand or by, for instance, investing in storage or by shifting demand from one time to another or by some other option. In other words, they would have the right incentives from the system and price signals would be passed through directly from the upstream renewable suppliers to them. We've got the strange position at the moment where, as we hinted at the beginning, everyone knows that renewables costs are falling. Everyone knows that renewables are taking a larger share of the electricity system. They might expect that prices would be falling too, but they're not in most cases. What we do is establish that link so that consumers could feel the fall in prices of renewables.
And on the second question, what about markets and policymakers? Do you think they have the appetite for fundamental change?
We understand that it's a fairly radical proposal. I think it's less radical than it seems because you already, in effect, have two separate markets. That is that, as I mentioned, renewables are effectively supported by long-term contracts and the conventional generators are supported by their income directly from the market. So it's not quite as radical as it seems, but I agree that it's really an awful lot for governments and other decision makers to take on because it's quite a complicated, it looks quite complicated, even if it isn't quite as complicated as it sounds. And most people don't understand how you can have two separate markets, which are still coordinated, that we've spelt out the details by which that would work. But I think the pressure to do something like this will eventually become so great that there'll be no avoiding it.
Interesting. Now, David, if I can come back to you, because in the paper you say one country that might wish to experiment with as available AA renewable options is, of course, Spain, where you live. And that is because the government's about to hold a central auction for renewable energy. So what is the aim behind your proposal for this experiment in Spain?
Well, the first thing to say is that, as Malcolm was pointing out, it's very difficult to convince a government or to adopt the two-market approach wholesale, upstream, downstream, in one go. This is an experiment to try one element of the model focused on the consumer end of the market, not changing the structure of the upstream, in order to see to what extent it's an experiment to see whether consumers are able and willing to become more flexible in their demand when they have the right incentives to do so and to consume when the contracted renewables are operating. Because there is an auction in Spain, it's worth saying that Spain is really a renewables powerhouse that the government intends to have, to have many auctions over the coming years. The plan is to have 60,000 megawatts of new renewables over the next 10 years. And our aim is to use these auctions as a way of experimenting with a demand flexibility. I can explain further if you'd like me to.
No, perhaps actually, it'd be useful to expand a little bit on that. But, what do you think the outcome of the experiment could be?
Well, basically, the idea is that we will be able to determine whether consumers actually are interested in consuming as available energy if they are, then we will have shown that provided they're given the right incentives, that we can actually shift demand so that it coincide with renewable renewable generation. And in that case, if it is successful, we will, first of all, we will have demonstrated that it's an experiment that's worth repeating, and that there'll be more demand for that type of auction, but also other types of contracts based upon the two-market model. Governments may be willing to look at this option both upstream and downstream. It has a very significant potential to enable governments to pass the savings of, that is, the lower costs of renewables directly onto consumers, which governments say they want to do. But I think perhaps looking in the longer term, we're talking about the development of a supply chain of software and hardware, batteries, smart services, which support demand flexibility, create jobs in whichever country is developing these services in this supply chain, and which is a global market. And what's interesting is that we're not talking about something which is a long way away. We already see companies which are beginning to support this model. For instance, large industrial customers with whom I speak are explaining how they could actually provide this flexibility if the incentives were right. And we're talking to software companies which are designing services to match a consumer's consumption with the renewable generation which they are paying for. So we already see the supply chain beginning to work. And the idea is to now put it into practice through these auctions to see whether we can achieve what we hope to achieve.
Interesting. Malcolm, can I come back to you actually and, you know, ask if there could be any implications of this for other parts of the energy sector?
I think there could. I mean, in the most direct sense, there'd be implications, for instance, for electric vehicles, because if the pricing structure in electricity changes, then that affects the economics of batteries and the degree to which it makes sense to design flexibility into the batteries within cars and to use them as a form of electricity storage rather than just, as I said, as part of the vehicle itself. There might also, I think, be indirect implications in the sense that if they can see that the electricity decarbonisation involves a need to change consumer behaviour, change institutions, change the way markets operate, that might stimulate them to think about whether similar changes are needed along with the change in fuels and sources in terms of decarbonisation of their sectors. And I think that's one of the most important lessons.
Interesting. Well, look, we are kind of getting to the end of the witching hour of this podcast, but you know, Malcolm and David, I always like to end a podcast by trying to look forward. Now, you say in the conclusion of your paper, fundamental changes are underway in electricity. The intention should be to let consumers participate actively in the process. The aim of the two-market approach is open as the way for them to be able to do that. So, David, could you perhaps expand on this statement and maybe give us some other conclusions from the paper?
Well, the key message from the paper is that while new technologies, in particular solar, PV, and wind, are needed to reduce carbon emissions, they are not the end of the story. Their effect is to change the whole underlying operation and dynamics of the system. For that reason, policymakers have to rethink market design and regulation. And because of the potential for demand flexibility to play an important role, our message is that consumers should be leading the change and not simply leaving all of the key decisions on issues of such as mix and the security of the system to central policymakers.
Okay, Malcolm, let me give you the last word, if I may, with a kind of quite a broad question, I may. What might be the next steps in electricity market reform?
Well, it's quite difficult to say, but I am certain there will be next steps. There is a large number of proposals on the table, and this is one reason why governments are finding it difficult to choose between them. But there is also pressure, I think, from the bottom up, as it were. There is a clear demand amongst many consumers to know if they are, in fact, consuming renewables. There are new industry developing, for instance, in tagging energy output against demand, and to show that people are not being, it's not just greenwashing, that people who say they're using renewables are genuinely doing so. I think demand flexibility is going to become increasingly important. And I think the momentum is increasing. And so that in the end, there will have to be electricity market reform. and that it's not likely to be a neat and tidy process, but somewhere down the line, we're going to have, we believe, something on the lines of what we proposed.
Well, Malcolm and David, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation that certainly builds on the messages from your paper, Glimpses of the Future Electricity System, Demand Flexibility and a Proposal for Special Auctions. And to our listeners, I really urge you to read this fascinating paper. And I know that Malcolm and David at the Institute will be really pleased to hear any views and opinions you have on that. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. And thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.